Hi, guys, and welcome. This is Jen Gaeta Siciliano, artist, memoir writer, bipolar psychiatric survivor, and your host of Not As Crazy As You Think podcast, the place that offers an alternative perspective on mental illness, highlighting creativity, non-conventional healing, and breaking on through to the other side. If you are ready for a new narrative on the mental realm that celebrates crazy and cool without penalty, then Not As Crazy As You Think is for you. Hello, this is Jen Gaeta Siciliano, your host of Not As Crazy As You Think podcast. Thanks for joining today. I am really proud and really humbled at the same time to announce that I just completed my two-year venture with podcasting. So it's a two-year anniversary. It was on Black Friday. I happened to be deathly ill this year with the flu during Black Friday, so I'm a little behind on this episode, but I wanted to kind of give a recap of everything that I've experienced over the course of my 2 years podcasting, and also what I've seen in terms of how the message is changing. Definitely, I fall into the group of psychiatric survivors, the prescribed harm movement, people who are highly critical of psychiatry. And at the same time, I am pro alternative healing for mental illness. I don't even respond to it in that way. Mental illness has a stigma of suggesting that this is like something that you can't heal from. It's chronic, it's forever. And it's just simply not true. You know, physical illnesses we heal from all the time. They want to be the same as physical illnesses. Most illnesses you can recover from. I mean, not everybody is, you know, resigned to living with a lifelong chronic condition. It's part of our lives that we know that you can heal from physical illnesses. So to put something in a category and say it's like a physical illness, but you can never heal from it, I knew from day one when I was labeled that it was a ridiculous concept. And I just was waiting for things to change. Unfortunately, things were so entrenched in the way things were in terms of how they saw it, how they, you know, where the concepts of mental illness came from. So by the time I was labeled in 1994, I had really no hope because I was silenced through heavy antipsychotics. Now, I bring all this up because it's the reason why I started the podcast. I have a drive to make sure that people understand the history of what has happened to the way we talk about mental illness, the way we see mental illness. And I call it mental distress because that suggests that it's a transitory experience and not a forever condition. So I knew that this was going to be a lifelong journey, that how was I going to penetrate the lies? How were those lies put out there to begin with? Like, why do people believe these things? It just didn't make any sense to me. But like I said, I was incapacitated. I wasn't able, they disabled me through these heavy antipsychotics in the 90s. You know, I was put on the ones before the atypicals came out, and they were treacherous. I mean, I'm very lucky to this day that I didn't suffer long-term tardive dyskinesia, or, you know, I did have it for a little while on certain meds. And thank God I kept pushing to get off these meds and change to something else. But the doctors were not very responsive. They saw it as, oh, your symptoms are being controlled. And I'm like, symptoms? Like, what? How do you view me and my brain? And what do you think is going on up there? You know, it just seems so barbaric, completely disconnected from reality. And they were telling me that I was disconnected from reality. So I knew it was going to be a life that I didn't sign up for. I had no agency once I was labeled and forcibly medicated. And I didn't see really how this was going to change. And it took a long time. It took decades. So when 2020 came around, I realized that, wow, my book is still not out there. You know, people still really don't care about this issue. But I did notice that a lot of people were suffering from states of mental distress because of lockdown, because people were dying. We all know what was going on and how things came to the forefront with mental illness. So I saw it as an opportunity. I said, you know what? I still have to get this information out there. People aren't taking this seriously, this point of view of mine. I'm going to have to take myself seriously and try to put myself out there and be brave, knowing that I still may be up against, a lot of criticism about my criticisms, but I put it out there anyway. So it really just started as me sharing some of my writing that I had done over the course of time on my blog about psychiatry, also some chapters of my book that I put out there to kind of get a feel for what people would enjoy. And I started interviewing people who, you know, were in my immediate select pool of people who were supporting me during this time period. So I had a couple of my therapists on. And then later, about 6 months in, I realized that in order to really get to the next level, you know, people were listening. People were responding to what I had to say. So I said, you know what? I can't move forward anymore without trying to at least put myself in a position where I can get off these meds. I can have a life beyond meds. I know that, you know, all the history of why these things aren't legit. So why not take a chance? Well, up until this point, the why not was very clear because getting off these medications is extremely dangerous. So I started doing the research. I found communities that I never really knew existed, that these people were coming together and sharing so much information on how to do this properly. Things have really been learned. And again, it's not the medical establishment that helped us do it. It's the people who have suffered, who are rewriting, okay, what it is to live a better life on or off these drugs. So I found groups like the Inner Compass Initiative. I found sites like survivingantidepressants.org. Huge amount of information on what people need to do in order to try to be safe during a tapering journey. And I started attending seminars. I started attending all different kinds of groups that would talk about these things, support groups. And I found other people like me, other people who were podcasting, other people who were trying to get their information out there. And it was wonderful. So, yes, it's been a long journey, but this podcast allowed me to continue moving forward in a way that was progressive, that was even further along the path of healing. And here I am, you know, able to speak about such things, right? Now, I am still of the generation where we were forcibly medicated, okay? And the things have changed. People are choosing medications now because they feel that they can get an edge. They feel that they could concentrate on their work. They feel that they could get things done, okay? And I am the absolute last person to hold any kind of moral high ground on this. Anybody could do whatever they want. I've always been a proponent of that because I wanted to do what I wanted, which was not to take the meds. But because of the theories, okay, they kept telling people who were bipolar over the years or labeled with schizophrenia, again, no test for these things. They just decide that you have enough of the qualities that they are looking for to be labeled with a lifelong illness. There's nothing to look at besides a survey and a conversation, oftentimes only about 15 minutes to get labeled. So I knew that I had to fight to be heard. And yet, at the same time, what I was seeing and what I'm still discovering is that the younger generations don't really know what we fought for or what we're fighting for. They think that we're against them because they want to take meds. Now, do you really think that somebody's going to tell you not to take those medications? Well, that's just like not true. And you know that. Anybody who believes that, that if a psychiatric survivor is talking about, you know, the critical parts of psychiatry that would change things for the better, it's not to say that we're like trying to get rid of all the medications of tomorrow. You have your medications, okay? Whatever you want to call them. The drugs. Let's wake up. It's not medicinal. None of these things are medicinal, okay? They create long-term problems. So what I'm finding is that this animosity is existing amongst the people who enjoy meds, and they don't want us to speak out. And I find that to be so sad. Nobody's trying to take away your drugs, okay? I am a proponent of using cannabis as a effective agent to help alleviate stress, help alleviate anxiety, come, you know, take the edge off. I grew up in a family who made their own wine. So that was something that I witnessed, you know, my grandparents, they would have their glass of wine at night, and I know that it was made and there was like love put into it. And it seemed like that was part of life, you know, like finding something to like kind of just like help the day along towards the end of the day. Any of these things have the opportunity to be abused, okay? But the thing that is sad to me is that most of the abuse that people who are psychiatric survivors are talking about are at the hands of doctors. Doctors are so quick to prescribe more than one medication. And once you do polymeds, then it's a new game, okay? It's not just about, oh, yeah, maybe one day I could taper off one drug. No. Okay, now it's complicated. Okay, your body is getting used to it in a different way. These things are interactive with each other. Pulling one out from the other could be difficult. It could be treacherous. Now, again, I'm calling out to be heard. I want everybody to understand the possible problems, okay? Because you may be taking it when you're a kid. And you may be taking it when you're a teenager, and you may be taking it in college, and you enjoy the feeling that you get, and you feel a little less stress over the, you know, whatever it is, whatever you're taking, a Xanax or an Adderall, or whatever these things are used to help make your life easier, fine. But do you really want to be on these kind of medications for the rest of your life? And if you don't, then here I am to say, do not put anything in the way of those who are trying to help you in the future, okay? You are seeing it short term. I went on recently to YouTube to explore this phenomenon, these young people who, you know, have all their ADHD sites, and, you know, they are influencers for the discussion on mental health. But they embrace medication in a way that's very clear to me that they're using it for a tool. So that's fine, right? But one of these girls, and I'm not going to say the name because I'm not out to criticize her or pull her down, you know, into ridicule, okay? But I must communicate this. You know, she has a cute little channel, whatever, and she's there for, you know, helping people deal with ADHD. She's a young girl. And she was communicating about how she wasn't taking her med for a couple days for whatever reason it was. And she was communicating how she felt. And she didn't feel great. Okay. And the first thing that she discussed was that she didn't know how to handle her emotions. And she would refer to these meds as they're good for her emotion regulation. And I said to myself, this is what she learned in the classroom, emotion regulation. Why do you have to regulate your emotions? you really only have to do it when you're dealing with a teacher who can't, you know, deal with one of the children, you know, possibly acting out or whatever the case is. And I know I'm in the classroom. I know how it can be. But don't get it into your head that you can't survive or there's something like there's biologically wrong with you as a human being so that you can't handle emotional things as they come up. What's happened is that the drugs allow you to not deal with it. Okay, they take your attention away from possible problems and or possible emotional distress that you may experience. And they allow you to do what you need to do, right? To do your homework, to concentrate, to tune things out so that you can focus. Now, as a capitalistic society who's obsessed with good grades and then a good job and all this, this sounds like, oh, it's, again, the wonder drug, right? All these things that have with all this promise. But there comes a time when you're going to want to deal with those emotions. And tapering now is an issue. Okay, so when you invite, and I must express this carefully, because when you invite that type of solution, say over medical marijuana or over a glass of wine or over exercise or over better sleep hygiene or better nutrition. I mean, I can give you, you know, 10 things to avoid on your list of foods that would instantly increase your mood stabilization. So, but most people don't want to give things up, right? So it's this type of thing where we are resistant to, you know, making positive changes in our lives that would take hard work. So we take the easy fix, but with an easy fix, it's not a, okay, everything's fine. You now need to deal with what comes with the easy fix, which is possibly having to taper. Tapering is not easy. I've spent about $10,000 this year on tapering, okay? And that has to do with all the doctors that I've employed to support me in this endeavor, all of the compound liquids that I had to take every up to like $200 a month. You know, when you take pills, they're a lot of the times they're fully covered. So it's a process to invite into your life. I don't know why anyone would do it. So that's why I'm critical, because I have gone through healing methods when they told me it was impossible, that I could never heal. They never, ever, ever decided to pursue any other way to treat, you know, these issues I have with sleep or these issues I have with my shamanic journeying. I go into these states sometimes. Nobody ever encouraged within the psychiatric profession a alternative way to look at this. Now, that's precisely because they look at things in a certain way. They don't entertain every reason why these things could be happening to you. They don't entertain all of the social reasons or all of the traumatic experiences. Believe it or not, most people believe that when they go to a psychiatrist, at some point, they could have a conversation about things. Well, that might not be the case, because mostly psychiatry is there for a 15-minute interview and just to prescribe drugs. And then once you get the drugs prescribed, you don't really even have to sit there for 15 minutes. You could just go and get your prescription and leave. So that's not care, guys. That's not care, okay? So yeah, I am pro-therapy. However, a lot of therapists do work alongside the idea that these things are biological illnesses. Now, there are things that are going on in our biology. If you're suffering from any kind of mental distress, they are seeing these things in brain scans, in all different types of things. But that's not causal. It's not the biology that's pathological itself and that's causing a state of mind that can then be rectified with a particular missing ingredient that you have in your system. And this is what they lied. They lied and they told everybody this for decades and decades. Now, this to me is a crime. And I'm not going to be quiet about it. You know, I made a comment recently on an Instagram post from another fellow a mental health advocate who I respect. She comes at it through an alternative perspective, also through nutrition and just how to balance your life. But, you know, there was a comment made and I made a comment back. And my main thing was, there are many, many people who are harmed by these meds, and I'm not going to stand by the use of meds as a, you know, like, hey, yay, 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 it's an option. I don't think it's the best option. I think it's there for very extreme cases. There are very extreme cases that, you know, sometimes you need to get like kind of knocked out of a state, okay? And that could be a psychotic state. It could be a state of absolute compulsivity, you know, with OCD. It could be very extreme depression where there's suicide concerns. But long term is not the way to go. In fact, all of these drugs are not tested long term. They're tested short term. And those are the studies that they preserve so that they could show that it works, these things. But we're talking like up to 8 weeks. So most people who are on these drugs are not on them for 8 weeks. They're not. You go to a doctor, a psychiatrist, and in a month, you then go back and tell them how you've been. So that's 4 weeks, guys. It's not, the treatment doesn't end after 2 months, okay? It's ongoing. So this is like completely trial by error, human experimentation, and it's been going on for many, many decades. So I'm not going to stand by that approach when I know that there's so many things that will help you in a better way. And oftentimes the medicines themselves cause problems that cause more distress. So the things that you think are being handled are getting worse because of all of the medication side effects and all the additional things that happen when you put your body in a state of being dependent on, you know, some kind of agent. Okay. So I had somebody, I'm not sure if she was young or old, I had somebody critique the fact that I critiqued and made a comment about how I should do my research. I have to laugh because it's so ridiculous. I wrote a book on this and I have a podcast on this. Yes, I do research, sweetheart. Okay. That I should do my research and see the how much these things help so many people before I open my mouth about it. And this is where I said to myself, this is the problem. You know, I understand. I don't want, now that cannabis is legal in New York and I'm able to speak about it, you know, up until it was legal, I couldn't really openly talk about it so easily because of the fear that, you know, as a bipolar taking cannabis, then I could be really like just pulled into the hospital for that. You know what I mean? Every time they found it, it became like an issue, you know, in my blood when they would do a blood test. So, you know, there was always this sense of why can't I just have the medicine I want? You know? So I get it. You don't want it to be taken away. But who is saying that it should be taken away? All I'm saying is that proceed with caution. I don't recommend it. I don't recommend getting on these medications. But if you are to get on the medications, proceed with caution because they will find more and more ways to medicate you and more labels because this is their system. And the system is known not to work. When I was ill over the holiday, I finally sat down and watched this 2021 series called Mysteries of Mental Illness on PBS. And I'm so happy that in a way I was able to sit and look through all this stuff. It shed light on so many things. And there's 4 episodes. And the first episode really just kind of dives into the history and the concept of what is this thing, you know, that is gripping the individual and making them look so really insane, right? Now, it's hard to place ourselves in a historical context because when I hear about all these things, you know, right away, if there was, say, a person who was experiencing hearing voices or they were just acting out in bizarre ways, you know, they were handled very, very roughly immediately because there was this sense that there was an evil presence at work. And so this heavy you know, reliance upon the narrative of mental illness is, you know, from the devil, really. You know, that was a problem. So the medicalization of it kind of relieved us from looking at the individual as just this, you know, container of evil spirits. Now, this is definitely in the past, okay? This is not something that most people are concerned with today. But I will say that aside from this idea that there's evil spirits, we can ruminate quite a bit on negative ideas, right? So that's that whole idea of like positive thinking, bringing that into the equation. Now, some people, and I can fall into this category as well, see overly positive thinking can be toxic because it's not realistic, right? There's a sense of if we understand the way the world works and we can accept it for where it is, you know, in terms of all its beauty and ugliness at the same time, we may have some better chance at dealing with mental distress when it pops up. So I'm a proponent of looking at things realistically. It's always been easier for me to see the truth and talk about the truth, even if it hurts. And that's part of exercising those areas in our brains that need a little bit more strengthening when bad things happen, when bad things arise. So we need practice. If we are always just turning to, say, medication to give us the edge or to give us emotional regulation or to give us, you know, whatever, then what, you know, how are we developing coping skills? How are we developing those things that can only be developed through practice? If you're not leaning on practicing getting better in those areas because you're leaning on a medication that takes away the need for you to worry about those areas, then, you know, at some point, it's not going to be a lifelong thing. At some point, you're going to want to probably face it head on. And my message to you is that you're completely capable of doing that. It's your brain. It's your life. It's your experiences. It's your interpretation of your world. All right. We have to realize that what we see through our eyes and through our lives, yes, we have a filtration system through how our brains are dealing with these inputs, but our environment has so much to do with why and how these mental distress states occur. And they're seeing this more and more. Two of the people in the PBS special, I was so happy to see that they were really huge contributors to the narrative and the conversation. Ann Harrington, who wrote Mind Fixers, Psychiatry's Troubled Search for the Biology of Mental Illness, which was published in 2019. And Andrew Scull, who wrote the book Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. Two fabulous books, just filled with high-level journalism. They cover these areas quite a bit. They understand the social systems. They understand the historical context of how these things were approaching, why psychiatry even went into a biological point of view. You know, at first, Freud had a lot more influence in psychiatry than he does now. Psychoanalysis is not the same as psychiatry. In fact, psychiatry oftentimes just poo-poos that. But, you know, in the beginning, that wasn't the case. So there was a sense of there was this thing that we had to unwrap, right? And then suddenly it switched gears for many reasons. And the Freudian concepts were problematic as well. They often blame the mother for everything that, you know, occurred in the child. There were lots of issues that were misogynistic and, you know, just far reaching. And also from a privileged perspective. So, yes, there were lots of problems. But the thing that we can still say today that is effective with psychotherapy is that it encourages self-reflection and it assumes that there are things at play that are unconscious, that we're not aware of, that determine a lot of the times things we do and say and feel. So uncovering those things in any kind of therapeutic session is helpful, okay? It does get to the core of where these things are, you know, affecting us in negative ways, okay? States of mental distress. The interesting thing about the program is that it was paid for by the American Psychiatric Association. So they're aware that this was a critical perspective. They did not hold back when it came to shedding light upon the problems of the past in psychiatry, which I thought that was really nice to see, because maybe, you know, can we meet halfway? Is there room for reform? Listening to the survivors of a past system that didn't work, are you going to listen to us, or will you take it, everything as a challenge to your authority? Because that's what it is. It's a personal challenge to your authority. They get so highly insulted. And this is creating a barrier for many of us to continue to put our voices out there. Because now the next generation is convinced that they still need their drugs for biological purposes. Meanwhile, there's no way. They don't utter any of the reasons why it's biological, because they don't do these kids who are taking these medications, they're not doing reading the studies that I'm reading. Okay? But they're telling me, you better do your research. It's sad. It's so sad. The second episode in The Mysteries of Mental Illness is entitled Who is Normal, which I appreciate. They cover a lot of things I actually discuss in my book. And one of the things is that they point to early on, society decided who were the deviants, right? So back in the day, a name that they came up with for a mental disorder was drapetomania, which was pinned on runaway slaves, because anybody who would leave the natural state of submission as a black person to seek freedom, there must be something wrong with them. So this was a typical mental disorder of the time, okay? And this is really how they come up with mental disorders. They point to, one of the things that they point to was during World War II, there was a growing number of PTSD victims. And there was this combination of instinct and experience that had influence over our lives. So this was very, you know, based again in the Freudian influence, okay? Because Freud believed there was no clear line between mental health and mental illness, that we were all in that state of it was a range of neuroses and how it could be expressed. But what was clear was that war is hell. It's so traumatic. And yes, some people can handle it better than others, but why would it make the people who were handling it less better, more mentally ill? See, it's the concept, right? I always looked at the people who couldn't handle war as being more peaceful people, that, you know, they don't have it in them to kill people, okay? It's hard for them to do that. To see something like that is very disabling to them. That, to me, is a positive thing, not a mentally ill thing. But at the time, they needed people to go into the trenches. So, you know, these were the problematic soldiers, right? The ones who couldn't follow through and get out of these states of mind that were holding them back, that were holding the war effort back. So it's how we look at it, that determines who is ill in our society. At the time in 1952, the APA's DSM had only 100 disorders. Now there's 374. And the problem at the time was that the diagnostic reliability was close to zero, because everybody had their own ideas and there wasn't like that much of a categorical system. By 1972, in a very famous APA meeting, psychiatrist John Fryer, who had already been fired by two psych psychiatry departments, stated at this meeting that I am a homosexual. I am a psychiatrist. This is the greatest loss. Our honest humanity, and that loss leads all those others around us to lose that little bit of their humanity as well. Now, at the time, homosexuality was considered a severe mental illness. So this particular meeting where he came out and said this was in 1972. By 1973, the APA voted unanimously that homosexuality is not a mental illness. Now, that's pretty, you know, random. The fact that they just made a decision that all of a sudden everyone is okay, right? They're not mentally ill. It's normal. That is a societal construct, okay? Now, there's a wonderful documentary called Cured that I saw about this very movement. And I really hand it to anybody who was involved with that movement at that time. And that really went from the homosexual community to the trans community, pushing forward this, you know, really fighting against the narrative that they were ill when they said, no, we're not ill. Okay, this is normal for us. And this is really what I've been saying my whole life. It's normal that I go through these states. I have had a visionary experience. I went back in what felt like going back in time when I was sick in India. And then when I came forward into the future, I had enough knowledge to know that, wow, this is unsustainable. And it blew my mind. But because I was loaded on heavy antipsychotics, there was no way to have these conversations anymore. It took me decades to get back the understanding of what I was able to witness and understand so clearly, instantly, when I had those experiences. But I was unable to really communicate that because the medication shut down my ability to communicate. So these are social constructs, okay? Anyone could look at anyone else and say, well, if you have those problems and you're mentally ill, well, what happens when you experience those problems? Are you going to take on that illness label so readily? Some people like being told that they have an illness. It makes them feel better. It makes them feel like, oh, okay, now we can identify it. But if the only treatment is medication, and again, it's not medicinal. These medications are largely tranquilizers or stimulants, okay? And they all they do is just change your output. Whatever you're doing is changed. So you have very little agency because most of what you do is reliant upon the medication as the determinant of your behavior. So I just couldn't live like that. I couldn't live like that. And, you know, things have been going very well. I've been tapering now for a year and a half, and I'm down to very, very, very little. So I am still with my doctor. You know, she told me yesterday, she's like, I would just tell you to stop right now, but I'm going doing it your way because I told her, you know, there's a way to do it. And, you know, I want to try to be as exact as possible to that way so that we can look at it as, you know, possibly this was a successful tapering experience, you know, and this is why. And everything, I have everything, you know, listed nicely as to, you know, how I went about doing this. So if anybody is interested in tapering, please feel free to get in touch. And there's many ways to do that. You can look at my link tree on Instagram at Jen Gaeta, because I want to help. I want to help people. I want to help people wake up, okay? Wake up out of the lies. Diagnoses have traditionally oppressed people, and psychiatrists have often seen themselves as the saviors. But I knew this was not the case. And when I would buck that, it was like they did not want to hear it. But people began to doubt psychiatry in the 70s when this whole thing came about with the homosexuality. So Robert Spitzer, who headed the task force of the DSM-3 in 1980, he was very methodical, and he created more specific disorders where a certain number of symptoms had to be met in order for a person to be given that disorder. Now, in a way, that helped legitimize some kind of objective system that people could agree upon across the board. Somebody in, say, New York can possibly be given the same label as somebody, say, in Florida, if they went by this DSM, okay? Because it was this agreed upon objective categorical system. But again, this is not biology, guys. It's a social construct. People got together and they talked about it, okay? And they came up with these ranges of symptoms. So still, the DSM often being a tool for the conservative class to determine who was the mental deviants of society, it would never have helped someone like me. It would have just, you know, continued to oppress people like me. The third episode talks about the rise and fall of the asylum. And there was a time period where there was a moral movement in the mental asylums. And it was led by Dorothea Dix, who is an American advocate on behalf of the mentally ill. And she wanted to see these big institutions created so that it would be kind of like a rehabilitation center where many people can come and rest and kind of get back into the swing of life. They had lots of therapeutic things there, but it didn't last. Okay. There was definitely a positive outcome to a lot of what they saw, but there was only supposed to be about 250 people in each of these institutions. And after the Civil War ended, many became traumatized and then institutionalized. And then it became like 10 times more than originally planned. The people were just, you know, smushed into these places. And they started doing wild experimentation, malaria therapy, sterilization. It was fueled by eugenics, this idea that some people were just, you know, again, biologically inferior. This also influenced terrible ideologies that Hitler embraced. I don't want to get into lobotomies because there are lots of good books out there that deal with this kind of thing, but I will tell you, it was a tragic chapter in our history that was happening. But the thing is, as soon as Thorazine came on the market, that was the chemical lobotomy. You would take that and then be sent home. That would be a way to get people out of these hospitals because a lot of people were getting stuck there and dying there. Thorazine is an antipsychotic. I have had Thorazine injected into me in one of my states. And, you know, these things have unbelievably, incredibly harmful side effects. Okay. And that was the beginning of the introduction to medication, okay, in the form of treatment. So, you know, yes, things have fine-tuned. Things have been, you know, a little bit more targeted, but not as much as people think. We have very little understanding of how the brain works. There were some people along the way who were proponents of, say, community mental health, but somebody like JFK, who put that out there in 1963, this Community Mental Health Act, 3 weeks later, he died, you know, and then it never really came to fruition. And by 1975, they had One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, right? So then everyone started realizing that, oh my God, this is like a terrible way to treat people. And then this deinstitutionalization movement came along, and that's when drugs became front and center. Community care was defunded. Prison money was flowing. So they just kind of redirected people who were experiencing mental illness into the prisons. It's so easy to get a diagnosis and it's so difficult for it to be erased. But we know that environment and experience are these huge factors. And yes, possibly it gets biologically stored, right? Or, and then that could be manifested in repetitive behaviors or certain ways of expression. But that doesn't mean that this can't be changed. Getting to the root is the key. Alan Francis, he was the person in charge of DSM-4. Since then, he's written books, his famous book, Saving Normal, really is the tell-all, you know, about what's going on in the system. And he became a major critic of the system. And he says, we don't know how any psychiatric treatment works. So the selection of treatment has nothing to do with our understanding it. It has to do with practical results. Okay? So, you know, there's a lot of people in the psychiatric survivor movement who are also loud proponents against ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. I've been on the inside with people who were going through ECT treatments. It was hard to watch because I saw that their memories were being obliterated right before my eyes. You know, they were forgetting things. And that's part of the treatment. Now, again, if you're that depressed and, you know, you sometimes you're just looking, you know, for help, for an answer. One of the women in the episode, she said it's very important to have choice. So that resonated with me. Okay. I believe in choice. I believe that everybody should have choice, but you should also have informed consent. The last episode talks about frontiers of the future, and they go over a bunch of different things, right? From this new treatment for, say, OCD, it's called deep brain stimulation, which I find to be a little invasive, but apparently that it seems to be helping this one guy, and he was really struggling, so I want to be open-minded to that. MDMA is a treatment, is a drug treatment that shows 80% improvement for people that use it. Cannabis treatment, of course, is an option, and also other psychedelic treatments. Because what they found is that, you know, in the 60s, they were experimenting with this at the same time they were experimenting with other drugs. And they saw that when these drugs, the psychedelics, leaked out into the youth movement, they were being used to kind of be anti-establishment. So right away, they became Schedule One substances. They were not more dangerous than the ones that they were pushing in psychiatry. In fact, it was the other way around. The psychiatric drugs were more dangerous. But they can control people better with them. So let's be realistic and reasonable about what drugs are, okay? Drugs are agents that change your thinking towards things, your feelings towards things. And if I was to give advice on this, which I do openly and frequently, I would definitely say you really should look into things that are less harmful rather than more harmful when it comes to these things. Reduction of harm. Cannabis does not affect you in the same way that a long-term benzo does, okay? It's so drastically different that, you know, again, you need to do your own research if you're doubting me. The main thing that psychiatry lacks is this sense that these things that are mental distressors come into our lives, or they manifest in our actions and our thoughts through a variety of ways. And it's not just a biological cause, especially since there's nothing to point to. There's no biological tests. There's nothing that we can say that says this is a pathogen, okay, and this is creating this state of mind. And there's nothing out there like that. So if we know that to be true, let's be realistic in the conversation, okay, and stop giving psychiatry so much high status when they don't take into account family, faith, community, and outside factors that can be influencing a traumatic experience that can then manifest in something, an undesirable behavior. I don't have all the answers, but I know the answers for myself. And I came to those answers without the help of psychiatry. And in fact, in absolute opposition to psychiatry. That's how I found my answers. So that's the story that I have. And that is my narrative. I believe that psychiatry is the problem with many people not getting better. See, it's okay to go get treatment, right? But if you're not given proper informed consent as to what these treatments do and how they are effective long term and if they can be ultimately successful long term, you're going to buy into the story that you are sick and you're going to need this to the day you die. Okay? And that's just not true. It's just not true. Okay? So when I speak out and, you know, I might be highly critical of the system, and you may be in the system and you say to yourself, well, it's helping me, so screw you. That's okay. You could say that now. But I have a feeling that that's not going to be necessarily the thing that you're clinging to 20 years from now. See, I've been in this system since I was 22. I'm 51. I have a lot more years in the system knowing that doesn't work. So just to wrap it up and bring it full circle, I am very thankful that I'm in a position that I'm in, that I can talk about these things, because I have put in the time and the research and the work to get my voice out there. And many people are seeing that these things should be questioned and should be discussed. I will say, just for the record, I did also watch two of the latest documentaries on Netflix called Take Your Pills. The first one's called Take Your Pills, and the second one is Take Your Pills Xanax. So it's like they're making, I guess, chapters or something, you know, based on the different medications. The first one really deals with Adderall, and the second one deals with Xanax, the benzo. So it's interesting because I am listening finally to these people who are saying why they want their drugs. You know, I'm starting to understand that, yes, it's a tool. It helps some people. But benzos are traditionally not to be taken for more than like 4 weeks. Okay. Big, big, big dangers having being on those for a long time. And I know people who are on them for a long time. You don't really think like this when you're young, you know, you start realizing it later. I mean, the kind of brain fog that I was experiencing 2 years ago was just, I couldn't do anything. And now, you know, I got a new job. I'm working full time. I'm creating beautiful art. I'm doing things that I need to do. I feel that how much time was lost under those forced medications. Again, for me, it was forced. It was always forced, okay? I could never get off them on my own until I found the support network that was needed. So if anyone is in that category that they're looking to start that process, you can easily reach out. You can look at any of my past episodes. This is going to be the last episode of the season four. And I thank everyone for listening and for, you know, giving me a chance to speak my story. The good thing that I'm experiencing today is that I'm not the only one. I thought most of my life I was the only one. And how was I ever going to come up against this monster of a power? But to see so many people are coming together over the course of time and finding each other to kind of, you know, lead others out of this false narrative so that they may have an opportunity to stabilize in a more authentic way. True mental health, you know, long-lasting mental health takes a concerted effort to always put in the forefront of our lives. And it takes a lot of work. It's not just as simple as taking a pill. So, but again, I'm not going to judge anybody who does that. I just want you to have informed consent so that you know what it's going to take to stop that course of action if you should so choose. So now that I've said my piece, definitely check out Mysteries of Mental Illness under PBS. And I'll see you next season. I'm going to try to get through the rest of the holiday season. I'm just trying to, I have a show in Bushwick this weekend and a few other things on my plate. So stay tuned for an episode around Christmas time and we'll start season 5 in that way. So thank you so much for listening. Thanks for listening to Not As Crazy As You Think, and don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel. And remember, mental health is attainable for anyone, especially those labeled with mental illness. Until next time, peace out.